Welcome to the Almost Reckless podcast. I'm your host, Amy Smilovic, and my guest today is Javier Perel, producer and music director, and the guy who's been behind our amazing runway soundtracks for the last 20 plus years. Does this feel weird? We've known each other
for we've known each other for 20
for so long.
Something years.
20 years. Yeah, a very long time.
A very long time.
Right. So why don't we start this off where, why don't you describe what you do for a living? You have a job that, like, it's one of those I feel like a million people would kill for, but like, what do you do for a living?
It is kind of hard for people to understand because it's not really DJing.
Yeah.
And it's not either music producing, because I'm not generally producing a new track, which sometimes I do.
Yeah.
But what I do, I select, edit, and produce the process of putting all this together,
yeah,
a soundtrack for a fashion show. Mostly is one of the jobs that I do. I have other ramifications of this.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, it's like I said, it's, I don't know if it is DJing. I don't know if it is producing. I think it's more like creating a collage, which in many moments of our career together.
Yeah.
This is what we illustrate the form, musical form that goes with a fashion show.
Great. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's what you do. And we have known each other since my very first show. And it's funny because you're the one that I've worked with the longest, because then John James, I started with the next show. But these are very long relationships that we've had here. And we always knew each other through the twice a year times that we would get together. But I know that one time we had dinner in Paris.
Yes.
Was such a great conversation. And I wanted to share that with people because, you know, you really are such a great example of someone who has taken such a circuitous route to where you've ended up. And I love going through that for people because, you know, I work with people all the time. I get DMs from people all the time. I have sons. I have people around me who they get concerned about where they're going to be when they grow up, you know, and how planned out is it supposed to be? And what do you start doing from day one to be like this guy who travels around the world creating these soundtracks for runway shows? And so I don't think there is a clear career path for that, but why don't you, like, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Madrid, and I lived there until I went to school in Sevilla in the south.
Yeah. What did your parents do for a living?
My father was an agricultural engineer.
Uh-huh.
And he worked for a sugar company.
Yep.
And like the biggest sugar company.
Yep.
My mom was a housewife.
Yeah.
She worked at home.
Do you have brothers, sisters?
I have four more brothers and sisters. Yeah, we're five. And I'm the baby by really far in time, because my older sister is 15 years older than me. So I grew up as like the baby, real baby.
Yep. What were you supposed to be when you grew up? Like what? Were there expectations on where you're?
All my sisters didn't go to college. They all finished school. Same with my brothers. They didn't go to college. So I was a hopeful.
Mm-hmm.
And so during high school and even before, there was always this expectation that I was going to be the one that was going to have a career.
Yeah.
with a degree,
yeah,
et cetera, et cetera. And I wavered. And I went in so many directions throughout all those years. Ended up in law school, even though I did have an artistic side in me and a passion for music and for painting and a sculptor, which we'll talk about it later, because I took a little bit of a sculptor years in New York in my first years. And so I don't know why I ended up going to law school. I wanted to be a diplomat. I had a very romantic idea of that, someone living in an exotic country in an embassy and working for the Spanish government.
Yeah.
I, I don't know, maybe a movie in my head. That's what it was.
I am curious. So a lot of some of the best employees that we've had on our team pursued law. This was Tracy. Yeah. Pursued law, went into creative. And I feel like from Tracy's point of view, she's just so inquisitive and curious and a debater. And so like, okay, law, right? Like that makes sense. Mm-hmm. But it also makes complete sense for a creative field as well. Not that it can't be creative to be in law, but, you know, a truly stereotypically creative field.
I don't think there's a lot of creativity in law unless if you can... Right, exactly. Or trying to fix something unfixable. But one interesting part of studying law is that it gave me a lot of regimen. And so I did apply that for later in my career. And so, as you know, I'm always prepared. I love to be always prepared. I'm a little over prepared, which is not good, because that way, like sometimes you start doubting yourself.
Yeah.
But I'm always prepared, and it's something that I don't know if it comes from law, but I do have that idea of work ethic that is important.
Yeah, because I think that's one of the common misperceptions that people have is that people bifurcate their time a lot. So they think, okay, I pursued law and that's not right for me. And now I want to become something in this music industry. And therefore, I could be a lawyer for talent. But if you really want to get into the other sides of it, I think one might think that everything that they've done up to that point is just for naught. You know, but I know that for us to have worked with you that long, that balance, creative and pragmatic, right? Like that stability was key. And I think, you know, there's a lot of tropes in our industry about what it means to be like what that guy would be who's the music guy, you know, when you would imagine like drugs and not being on time and just being very
crazy hot.
Crazy, right? but that burns out really quickly. And because you're unique, right? Like
I hope so.
Yeah. No, but I mean, there's a reason why you've worked as long as you have. You've had such consistent business partners, and I'm sure the who you were that made you interested in law, the training that you got when going for that, applied hugely to what you do.
I think so. I think there's family also that, like, I learned a lot from my father that, like, he was a very responsible person, incredibly responsible. So was my mother. Yeah. They're both gone, unfortunately. But I learned their moral codes were very important and they were transferred to me for sure.
What's an example of how they, like, do you have one that?
I don't think there was always a moment of rebellion at home. We were all very kind of like bottomed up in some ways, but not because of fear. It was because of the way they raised us.
Yeah,
it was kind of like, obviously my father had his moments where he was a little bit strict, but it just came naturally. It was very, it was observed by all brothers and sisters, and we were all very, like, very good to our, like, we had a really good relationship with our parents.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because with my parents, I mean, I did shit, right? But at some point, you really did not cross that line, not out of fear, but I just would never have wanted to let them down, like, you know, but and not just for them to have been disappointed in me would have been me really disappointed in me, you know, like that was really important.
I think letting down your parents is unavoidable, because there was one period of time, you know, since you are 15 till you come back in your 20s at some moment. Yeah. But there's that moment where, like, obviously you want to go out, obviously you want to arrive late in the morning. Imagine Madrid in those days in the 80s. So, oh my God, well, you need to be. It's really right now flourishing. It always has been, but it's doing great right now. It's one of the biggest centers in Europe. But yeah, I think I disappointed them in some moments, but I don't think I was always chastised as like the black sheep of the family, which I don't think there's a black sheep in my family. I was the only independent one. That's the only independent one for sure. Yeah.
So when you're in law school, mm-hmm. right? What did it look like when you are thinking this is not for me and trying to figure out what is for you? Like, how did you know that it was music and that you would do this pivot? Or did you just know that it was something not law related?
It was something not law, but I was so stubborn. And I gave it a try and another try and another try until finally I took a job in Sevilla that paid me well.
Yeah.
Save my money,
yeah,
and move to New York.
And so you're touching down in New York with a job, with anything?
Nothing. With a visa, luckily, because in those days it was easy to get a visa at the American Embassy. So I arrived with a visa and a friend who, his name is Jay, and he's actually a fashion show producer. It happened in parallel worlds in some way. Well, there was a few connections, and we worked together once in a while, and we have worked together in many other instances before. Anyway, we were roommates for a few months, and then I started taking jobs because I needed, like, my money disappear.
Yeah.
And
what would be, like, the jobs that you were taking to get through at this time?
So I worked at a men's store in Chelsea called Camouflage. It was one of the greatest men's store. And one of the owners, Gene Chase, was my mentor, who polished me in ways that, I was already a curious person. I had a wide range of interests, but he channeled those into the maximum that I could, that I could get from him. And it was very interesting because he was a gentleman. He was very well put together, with a very kind of devious character. He had been a DJ, funny enough, who played at the after parties post Studio 54. When Studio 54 closed doors, then they would move to all these other parties, and he was one of the DJs. So, but you would never think that he had been this character. He had now this very successful clothing store. And
so I'm just curious how those moments come about. Because for a lot of people, they think of it as like just luck. Lucky that your friend was doing like runway production, and then lucky that you're working for this guy who happened to be a DJ. But a lot of people just kind of go through life, maybe not recognizing the value of the friend when you're kind of at the same level, or recognizing that this guy isn't just the guy that's stamping your timesheet, that there's like a lot more of a relationship to be had that could go on to other things. Like, how did you even with him, because he's your employer, like, how did that really get to that point where you are talking to him and he's like, was he just a very open person wanting to help you?
Yes. And in the sense of a mentor, like a real, like, he knew what he was doing. He took interest in me. He saw potential in me, and he wanted to help me into becoming a person in New York that had all what it needed to be out there.
And so when he was describing to you what he did, the DJ and everything, was that like a new world to you that?
While I was in school, I DJed in Sevilla.
Okay.
I didn't bring all my records because they were very heavy, because in those days were vinyl, even though I recovered some from a friend. But I started collecting records in New York. It happened that a second roommate was also a DJ, a connection to fashion through a designer, Victor Alfaro, who I helped in creating some soundtracks.
Yeah.
And that was kind of like the beginning, who introduced me to the producer, who was Kevin Cryer. And slowly all these things starting to connect one with another. A friend of mine in Spain, Amaya Arzuaga, started her line. We're friends since we were kids. I started her line. So I started doing all the music from here, mm-hmm. send it, because there was no budget to fly to Spain or to Barcelona where she was showing. But soon enough, she started showing in London. With more budget, I went to London. I did her first show in London. That became my demo. And that demo I gave to a couple of producers in New York, mm-hmm. who thought it was great. And
how did you find those producers in New York?
All friends.
So that I'm curious about too, because I find that, and maybe it's like this era of like LinkedIn and everything where you somehow are getting the notion that a mentor is someone that you could just like to follow on Instagram or something, and it happens. But I think what a lot of people don't understand is that these groups that, like, if you think about like Patti Smith and Mapplethorpe, right? Like they were all living in the building together, right? Like they were. Patty was Patty and Robert was Robert, and they weren't Robert or Patty until they were together in all this like future, right? And so I think really leaning on the people that are around you rather than trying to go four or five rings up, like creating those groups that support each other. It sounds like in your world that was a group that was like really helping each other out.
Exactly. And it was also a fraction of what it is right now.
Yeah.
Because there was so much.
Give me the year just to put context on things.
This was around 95 to 98 was kind of formative. 98 was when I started scoring shows. Like that was the first commission, this is your client. This is what you have to do. And from then on, I started with one, second season was two, third season three, mm-hmm. and they started to multiply. And there were many other jobs in between.
Yeah.
Because it was very, very, very small.
Yeah.
Like I remember when you started showing, by then it was like 9, 10, 11,
yeah,
12.
There had been.
It was at the hour a show.
Yeah.
In the beginning, it was like, one at 11, the next one at 2.
Right.
Then five, then 8.
Yeah. When I was there, it was like, you got to compete to get on that fashion calendar, the 10th Mercedes-Benz Fashion Week, the whole.
And so it was very, very small. There were very few shows in New York. And so.
And was it, so it's very small, right? And so technically, like there must, it wasn't like an official industry per se. Like you didn't feel compelled to get an industry playbook to find out how it was done, or was there somewhere where you could kind of get the ropes of how this worked?
There were only two DJs or music directors or whatever we want to call them that would come from Paris, and they had been doing this for quite a long time, and they're still doing it because they are famous, because they, you know, when you work with Carl and Prada and all this, and they were already huge, so it's tough. But I was tough to compete. But I was able to get quickly behind them, and in occasions taking some of their shows, and vice versa. It just happened that is normal in the industry.
Ever feel like an imposter at all, though? Like, was the industry established enough that you felt like you were kind of?
I think one was kind of a little jealous that mm-hmm. I took my first client.
Yeah.
It was one of his shows, but they weren't happy with them.
Yeah.
We're not going to name anyone here. But and yeah, I remember there was a little bit of bad mouthing, but it, there was already
enough. But that's going to happen for a minute, right?
But there was already enough work for everyone, at least the three or four that we were working in this.
Well, I'm curious, like, I mean, you said you did your friend's show in London, right? So was that, like, you must not, did you feel tremendous pressure because it was your friend's show in London? Or did you feel very little pressure because you're like, hey, listen, we're friends. I'm new to this. You need some help. Like, was it an easier way to get in and kind of feel the ropes?
The truth is I always feel a certain, a little bit of pressure. If you don't feel pressure, you're doing something wrong. So if there's not a tiny little bit of challenge in the creation or in the or the creative process, and you probably know with your collections, if it comes too easy, then you could start kind of like doubting yourself and thinking, something is wrong here.
Did you have to, Tracy and I, in the design process, we actually had to hard code that as something to watch out for, because we noticed that at the end of a runway show, if it went so smoothly all the way through, if we were complimenting each other, if no one got upset, and we were high-fiving after the show, those shows fucking sucked in the end. Like, for me, it was the Hong Kong Garden. I refer to the shows by the songs. Hong Kong Garden, like, oh my God, I hate this show so much. Oh my God, it was just such a worse show. Oh, and it was literally like, it was like Asian inspired. It was Asian, like, it was the worst show. And we were so nice to each other throughout that whole show. And there was always such an undercurrent of something that was not good. And yeah, when it goes that smooth, you're really... For us now, we know that is a warning sign that we're not being clear enough. We're not digging hard enough. One of us has got to have some friction in order for it to know that it's really good.
And friction, if it is necessary.
Yes.
You know, like, it, and friction doesn't mean, it, I don't think it has a negative meaning in this case.
It's friction just, is great.
Friction is great.
Yeah. Like a subway train that is not working for no reason, that's bad friction. But yes, like someone who's poking and asking the question, you know, calling out even an elephant in the room, that's a really, really good thing.
Yeah. And challenge sometimes when you find two pieces that they don't really make sense, but then you, and the puzzle is solved slowly and they finally blend together and they look great, which happens with music and it happens with colors or with fabrics or shapes.
Yeah.
It's a great moment.
Yeah.
It's like when things really matter. Actually.
Good things happen.
Yeah.
So now you're this DJ, you're in New York, you're actually getting some good business from these, you know, like these big players in Europe. Was there a goal that you had in mind, something that was that you thought that, wow, if I just hit this mile marker, I will have made it?
It's a fickle industry. You know as well. And because it's so cyclical, every season was like another fresh start.
It's starting from scratch.
It starts from scratch. So you have to book your shows. You have to get your, you know, your lineup. Sometimes was unmanageable, the amount of work that I had. That it was crazy. But it was great because, you know, you work for two and a half months and then you have a little bit of time off and then you take some projects in between and all that. And so it was never like I won this goal. What I did know is, or had this idea, is that which we were talking the other day in our little preview, was what was going to be the future. And so the one thing that I was a little fearful is to be stuck in this for forever. And so I didn't, and that was one thing that kind of like threw me off in terms of like, I want to be this big. I don't, also because you don't know how big you can be ever. And it was an interesting thing of realizing now versus what I was thinking 15 years ago, is that actually working at this point of life in something that I actually created for myself and that I really love, and that keeps me busy and connected and curious and engaged, it's a way of aging really great, because there's a youthful element in it. There's like something that I always want to learn. I always want to look at more material and more music and more references and anything that makes it productive and rich. And so that, to me, I didn't know that was a goal. But this, to me, this is a great goal. It is actually a good goal. To be the number one, it's impossible. Like, I don't want to. I don't know if that would have felt great.
Yeah, I don't. I hear that from a lot of people, and I know that's what we went through at Tibi. Was at some point we had put together these goals, but realized that one third of the way there was where contentment was.
Yeah.
And contentment to me is my happy place. Like, I feel content to have good discourse, to take risks, but not so much that I could lose everything. You know, that's like my good space. And I'm just curious for you, like, when you realize that working with good clients, creating good music, doing things, you know, was there a point where you did things more on your terms versus before? Like, did you ever have to take a client that was shitty just to make sure you could pay a bill? And what would a shitty client look like?
Yeah. And clients sometimes turn around and do something shady.
Yep.
And become nightmares.
Mm-hmm.
There were definitely a few ones that I was like, I don't feel this.
Well, I'm going to bring this up now. This is a good time because we have worked together for a very long time. And I think what's amazing is since 2005, and so now it's 2025. So we've had, we've done like 40 runway shows together. That's like a few, like give or take with COVID-y. So maybe like 35 runway shoes. Oh my God. And then we have to count Swim.
Right.
Remember that Swim system? We have done like at least 40 shows together. And of 40 shows, we had one that was, a difficult moment, but I want to give it as an example of something that I really admired about you at the time. And I think was such a source of bad friction for me at Tibi was we had, for everyone listening, there was a situation where I was feeling like so good about the runway show and the music, and Tracy had really slipped in there that she wanted the song Penny Lane, right? And Penny Lane, I like it, but for me personally, I would never have imagined it for a runway show. I kind of didn't question it or stop it at the time. And then I remember it was the night before the show, you sent over the soundtrack, and it was like, dun, da, dun, da, dun, dun. And I was like, holy shit. Like, there was just no lift in it. And I remember every time before a runway show, we would go in the car driving home to Greenwich, and I would turn up the volume full blast in the car. It would make Frank crazy, but I'm like, I need to hear it full blast in the car. This is the best way for me to get a sense of how it's going to feel on the runway. And like, I couldn't get that volume up loud enough to get like energy from Penny Lane. And so I remember calling you, and you were like, Amy, what the hell? Because you had actually sent the music to me like 2 days ago. You didn't wait until right before the show.
Oh, no, no.
I waited
2 days.
I waited to dig into the music.
Yeah.
And that was really bad on my part. And I mean, it's Fashion Week in New York. Like, you had so much on your plate. And I just started like, first of all, trying to direct this because I just needed anything but Penny Lane. And I remember at one point, it was like 11:30 at night. Yeah. And I was like, I can come over to your apartment. And you were like, no, you are not. You were so not coming over to my apartment. Oh, my God. But I really appreciated, number one, you didn't just say, screw you. You had this for a few days. No, you didn't say that. You made it work. You really made it work. You said, no, you're not coming to my apartment. Thank you. Even though I was the client or whatever. But you had your line in the sand there, you know, and you knew that the outcome would not be good. Right. But I just really appreciated how you dealt with a very difficult client in me at that time. And,
We had a late night music meeting over phone where I was like, over the phone, because in those days, well, I mean, we still use phones.
But you couldn't like just text over.
No, it was all live. And I remember playing you New Choices. And you were like, yes, I like this. Yes, I like this. Because from the very first time, we created a formula that it was like, you called it the TV remix. Yeah. And so it was like how intricate we worked certain identifiable moments in the soundtrack that were looped or they would be layered. I remember that was the moment of the mashup in music culture. So we tried to create our own mashups where there was a little bit of, I remember the first one was "Sis a Rainbow," the Rolling Stones.
Show number one.
So the classic riff of the beginning of She's a Rainbow was kind of like sample.
The Bizarres.
The Bizarre, yeah, was over and over sample over other things. So one of your comments was like, where is my TV remix? And I completely understood what it was, but that lack of friction, I think, that happened in the music meetings took me to like a singer-songwriter. Soundtrack. And I was like, well, if that's what they fill in, is singer-songwriter this time. But it wasn't a TV remake. It wasn't like that uplifting early TV, because in TV we have gone through like so many eras, let's call it, where like we break the mold and go in a different direction.
Yeah, because there was a time where it was like you always had to have like, was like the Ting Tings.
Yeah,
the,
because like, it was the music
Santa
of the moment.
Gold, like, yeah, it was.
As well, yeah.
And there was such a sound that we were locking into. But no, I just really appreciated how you dealt with a difficult client. And I'm just curious, like, for those who don't make it in your world, those who are not as successful as you, is it a bad ear for mixing music? Is it not an ability to work with clients? Like, is it just not having enough fire in your belly to, like, what are the things that make someone in your world fail?
I don't know. I don't have that many friends in this world. I did have a couple and they quit. Some didn't want to deal with the pressure. Because it's, in some ways, it's client services as well. And so some had anxiety issues in dealing with stylists and clients that were a nightmare. But I don't know. I don't know what it is. Like, I hear things from others that I'm like, great, that was amazing. Other times from the same one, I was like, that was lazy. So if something that I hear sounds lazy to me, I don't know how it sounds to the rest of the world and that client. So I have no way to describe what is how people, you know, how other people fail. Because I think it's also very subjective when you have a big name, let's say, in this world. It was like you can play sometimes whatever and everybody will clap. I mean, there are shows that are basically one song. And everybody is like, oh, the music was amazing. And I was like, yes.
Press play. Yes.
But you just stretch one song over and over and over. So, yeah, it's their heads. This is some one stylist told me one time because she described this as like, well, that came from a different head.
Mm-hmm.
So, and which I understand. But it won't come from this head.
Yeah.
And so the same thing could be applied as I, this come from my, this ears, and the whole audience in this case have to have those ears.
So when you, if you think about like 2005 and what really excited you about what you were doing and your industry, is it the same stuff that excites you today?
Yeah, it's just a different kind of music.
Mm-hmm.
Like anything that we were listening in those days has become a little obsolete. And I also think that as I'm older, I react to a little bit more of a grown-up.
Shut that music down. It's so loud. But I think that what's great in our industries, which I think applies to other industries as well, they just maybe don't know it, but it is always changing. Like, that's a great thing, you know, staying on top of what's happening out there.
Oh, and I enjoy what a 17-year-old is doing in his bedroom. And I understand. I completely understand what that sounds, and if there's value and it works for something, I'm like, yes, you're great.
How do you stay really present with what's going on?
Reading, listening. Like if I have, I don't know how many tabs on my browser that I go every day. Just looking for the new, like, this new single, this new advance, new artists. And then I have many that I kind of like always hoping that there's something new. I also have artists that I keep listening all the time. Like, for example, Philip Glass, which we used in the last show, who is probably my hero. One of my heroes.
And why is he one of your heroes?
I think he's the ultimate contemporary composer. And there's a beauty and a sadness and a repetition that many people find it annoying or boring. But music is repetition. And he makes the simplicity of that repetition and like the minor changes that are in the composition, a masterpiece.
I think one of the things that's interesting too was I was was watching a documentary on Scorsese the other day, and you know, I was thinking about so many of the documentaries that I love, the biographies that I love, and in nearly all of them, every character goes to such extremes. You know, Scorsese, like after Taxi Driver and a few others, like he ended up in the hospital almost dead from just basically just doing coke 24/7 to stay awake. You know, Steve Jobs, right? Like running around barefoot, letting his health go. Richard Branson, bankrupt, profit, like unbelievable, like highs and lows. And I was thinking that is because that gets so much attention. It's almost like the algorithm before there really was like the algorithm, right? Like it's what gets served up as what a creative looks like or what someone who is a high achiever or someone who's an entrepreneur who really goes out and does things, that it looks like these really extremes. And I don't think you live your life in that extreme.
No.
But you've got an extremely interesting life. Do you get really stressed? Because I've never seen you.
I can be. I project this calm person, but I can also be high, very high stressed.
Do you think that, because if I think about the process of how we work together, and now Gabriel's a big part of that process, right? And I think that one of the things in our process, I can't speak to how other designers, creative directors do it, but for me, identifying a song that just kind of feels like my mindset of the collection for that season is so critical. And not to dictate what the music is for you, but just to, it's kind of like in clothing, I have to give Tracy like very extreme sketches to show her where my head is. And so in the music world, it helps to communicate with music. And sometimes it's as simple as being clear that like, this is about drums versus strings or whatever, you know? And I find that when you intellectualize something first, it kind of lays a groundwork for creativity to happen. And for me, if things start being spitballed creatively without any framework, that really makes me anxious.
So my day-to-day life, the way I run my life, is very like sometimes almost, not, I wouldn't say chaotic. I do have systems because I have to create systems, but I can be easily distracted. So I'm like, can go this way and then turn the other way and end up there. You understand a little bit of what it is. When it comes to work, I'm the opposite. I have to have my time and my structure and my plans and my playlists in the bags, or like I call it bags of rejects. And you'll be surprised how much music I listen for every project. Like for a show, like hours. When it's very clear, like the last one, maybe there were 90 pieces of music or more. Mm-hmm. But for one that is a little bit more not described and like a little broad in terms of inspiration, it could be more.
I was thinking one of the hard things for people to figure out in their life, and especially when you're younger, is what are you going to be good at? Because you try and take these things that are happening and make sense of them. And then the people around you, whether it's parents, teachers, friends, they're taking the things that you do and they're trying to make sense of it. So it's interesting when you just described the way that you are, because I'm chaos in my regular life. I'm just chaos in my regular life. But when it comes to like work and the brief before a show and the lineup and how it is that we're going to do it and are we on message, and like I am very, 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 specific. And it makes me crazy if people come to me and I'm like, if you haven't read the brief, like fall in line, it makes me crazy, right? Because this is how I organize things. And I'm very organized there. And I'm very organized in my head when it comes to this stuff. And I think that if someone's watching you from the outside and trying to help you and direct you into what you can be in life, they might be like, Javier, no, like if you're so chaotic and in your regular life, like there's no way that you could actually run your own business, run your own self, manage relationships with clients, be able to provide feedback on music, organize it, like, but yet you excel there.
Yeah. And maybe, and maybe the regimen, like how regimented your work is and your work ethic is, splashes sometimes into my day-to-day life. I have systems also in my day-to-day life, because otherwise, right, you need to. But I'm easily discouraged for certain things and postpone things and, you know, procrastinate. But I never procrastinate about work. That's one thing that I never wanted. Sometimes, like I said, I'm like over-prepared because, you never want to be late. You never want to arrive with like three crappy ideas.
Yeah.
It's not acceptable. And I don't want to sound too, you know, Mr. Perfect in that sense. But,
But it is perfect for you.
It's perfect for me. Yeah, exactly.
It's perfect for you. Yeah. And that's the thing, too. I think that there's one thing to figure out, like, what are you really good at? And to not be good at one thing doesn't mean that you'll be bad at another. There might not actually be any correlation between the two of them. And then perfection is very subjective. And what's good for someone is very subjective. And that's why I think that it's so critical for people to figure out what their measuring stick is for success. And like we were saying at the beginning, you said that when you realized that you were working for yourself, that you were creating music, staying on top of things that were happening, which makes anyone feel modern and current, that's a really good thing. Like,
yeah,
that is the...
That's one great goal to aim for, I guess. Yeah.
Is it the end goal? It's kind of the end goal, right? I mean, health, all that stuff too, but.
It is the end goal. I think it is the level of happiness that can bring you.
Yeah.
I don't think happiness is 100%. Or not even 80 in some moments. Happiness is kind of like a up and down. There's days that I'm happier than others. But I think this, if you can love what you do and be good at it and enjoy what you're doing, and approach it with care and it's important. I think it is. I think from a client point of view, if you see that I'm bringing something that I care for, I think that's also a good level of trust that is important to like also to come up with something that is great and creative.
So where would you draw the line with a client now? Like if they just dictated a playlist to you, is that a hard line for being drawn or?
No. I'll give my recommendations always, and I'll try to have some clarity, steer some clarity into this situation in which maybe this is what you feel, but I think this is wrong in this for these particular reasons, and maybe this is better. That is part of the job sometimes. Yeah.
One of the analogies I like to use is life is a little bit like a Seurat painting. You know, it's like when you step back from it, you can see the beautiful painting that appears. But when you get up close to it, it's just a series of all these little dots that ultimately come together. And I always think about what the dots are that I was creating when I was little that have kind of led to the picture of where I am today. And I'm curious for you with music, was that something that always permeated your household when you were younger? Like, was that a big part of your life?
It was. It wasn't a very high-tech house.
Like, I mean, we had an 8-track player that was like very exciting.
We had a pickup record player that kind of, but like, you know, the ones that the cover became the speaker. And my sisters had a huge collection of 45s. So I was able to go to my room and play records.
Was it global music? Was it more localized or?
They were mostly British, French, Italian, and Spanish pop artists. That could be the Beatles or the Mamas and the Papas. Well, Mamas and Papas are American. Or Serge Gainsbourg was there. And that was my first connection to music. And then quickly I started recognizing pieces that were part of like soundtracks or classical or disco.
Was music always on in your household, like from your parents at all? Or was it more something that the kids were doing?
More the kids. My brother had a huge collection as well. And he was really into disco, which is funny for a straight man in the 70s.
My parents really got into disco, though. That was, they opened up a disco on our island, and it was like a small Georgia town.
I mean, he was kind of, it was funny because he was into Mike Oldfield.
Yeah.
Or Donna Summer.
Yeah.
Or Grace Jones.
But I mean, it was Saturday Night Fever had come out in this, right? And that was like, my parents had gone to see it and they came home and like were twirling all over our house. I was like, oh my God.
That I discovered. No, I think it was my brother. I was more like a Grease childhood as well, because
that's what we performed in the garage was because my sister was the youngest. She always had to play John Travolta. And she was like, why?
It was probably one of the first movies that I went with friends to see, John Travolta and Olivia Newton-John. And then we
kind of over and over again, too.
Like, oh, yeah. And then we played the record a million times at my friend's house. Like, just like, you know, what teenagers do. Really young teenagers. And then on my own, I started creating my tapes, my mixtapes from a radio station that was playing really cool music. And that went from new wave, early new wave, even like more like punk, country. So for some reason, I developed this obsession with country music in Spain because it was... This guy would play Emmylou Harris and Willie Nelson and John Denver. And so it sounded kind of exotic in a way, but it was really, it was kind of one more layer of genres that I was adding to my, I didn't know in those days, but yeah, music was from the very, very, very first moment, an important part.
Did you notice that you were talking about it like in a more obsessive way than your friends who were like, dude, I just like the song. Like, were you wanting to go deep? Like, cause you went down some I mean, you're reeling off Emmylou Harris and John Denver and like your friends were probably like, Javier, like chill. In a good way.
I would talk with, cause I don't think there was one person that had all this, knowledge on so many, and I don't want to sound pretentious, but if there was one person that liked The Police, the first album of The Police, I would talk to him about The Police and he would give me all the information that he knew, because he probably knew more about The Police than I did, but I liked The Police. So Susie and the Banshees, which I became obsessed with her, and unfortunately we play Hong Kong Garden, same thing. Like the first time I went to see her in Madrid at a concert, I didn't really know much about her music, but I was drawn to that force. Also, the music was like mayonnaise because you couldn't really it was overblown and loud, and you couldn't really understand what instrument they were playing because it was a wall of sound. It was just, but with no purpose. Like I wasn't like, oh, I'm going to do this. It was just, and you know, adding to what it became later.
I think that's one of the things too that is a little daunting to people is, so when I was saying that I just watched the Scorsese documentary, like in that documentary, they were like, okay, Martin at age like 8, everyone knew that he was like walking around, you know, Little Italy and just seeing things through a different lens, you know, like he knew from the beginning, like, and, you know, he right out of high school, he's like, he found NYU that like he knew where he was going. And of course, like backstage after runway shows, people always ask me, they're like, were you just making like 5 million outfits for your dolls? And I wasn't, but I loved art and I loved, you know, and I think it's disconcerting for people because you somehow believe that if you weren't that kid who was like, I will be this DJ and like having this like stereotype of, I don't know, whatever a Rick Rubin or someone would have, like that maybe that's not, maybe you're not the real thing.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Like the concept of authenticity.
Yeah.
Which is like, it was thrown very much in those days when we were kids and we were like late teenagers. It's like, what's authentic? Are you authentic? Are you, you know, and I never really thought that that was important to be authentic, just to be curious. But because a lot of authenticity didn't give you a very wide variety of possibilities. You have to be just this. You have to be either in those days when tribes were very important in the 80s, and we were all trying to do like cosplay of new romantics or rockabillys or post-punk or goths or things like that. That was the 80s. You could be accused of not being authentic. And I was always like, but if I'm not authentic, if I'm so authentic, then what if I want to be something else tomorrow?
Yes, because authentic...
Authentic
then was
like,
actually the definition of non-authentic,
right?
Really, because right. It was authentic by someone else's terms,
right? But I mean, to me, authenticity it was kind of like something that would put you on a box,
yep.
And I didn't want to be put on a box because I actually changed through weeks. Like all of a sudden, I would be a completely different person,
yep.
And that was fun.
I love that. I love that. So. On that note, like when we spoke last, you said to me that like 20 years ago when we first met, even like you wouldn't have imagined that you would still be doing today what you were doing then with twists for sure. But that's the way life works, right? Like,
yeah, it's. I think it's the daunting part of aging. And when you look at aging, like from maybe when you are 35 to 40 and you envision yourself at 60, you'll be like, I'm not going to be doing this at 60. That'll be ridiculous. That'll be pathetic. Why? How am I going to be this person doing this? But then you reach that age, which I already reached 60.
You did.
I did. Yeah.
Congrats.
Thank you. And it wasn't that difficult.
it just happened.
It just happened. And then you are like, no, I want to keep doing this. I want to keep working. That element is the past looking at this and we're here. It has, and it's your life. Yeah. And it's like, and it's the, and it's what I keep doing is I'm still doing this and I'm enjoying it. So no changes.
I love it.
Although I want to go back to one thing that I didn't discuss, which were the 3 years where I took a sculpture at Parsons.
Wait, sorry, go back. Yes. But so where, how did that, so and you was, did it at Parsons. You took sculpture classes at Parsons.
I did one, very few classes at Art Student League. And of course, the level of the Art Student League was very high. And I was just a clumsy clay, you know, player, like a little kid. And so didn't last. And moved to Parsons. Parsons was a lot easier. And it was actually my friend Gene Chase who told me, it's like, you should just go for it and take these classes. Interesting enough, the first year I was a student, and the 2 years later I became the assistant of the professor. And I was not bad, actually. All the models that I had disappear in one move when I moved apartments, because I was like, because what happened also is like music became much more important than that. And I had to choose in between what my time was going to be. And while I didn't see any professional future in being a sculptor, which I, there was no, and it was just a hobby.
Yeah.
And I have to say it in this moment right now. When I was doing it, I was like, oh, I might be a sculptor, but music started to be much more, much larger and profitable and interesting.
I think that, you know, going back to like also like just being very creative and pragmatic at the same time, I think that it's possible to be very passionate about something and to be very interested in something, but not really be able to find your niche or how you're going to be the best at it. You know, like for me, I'm really passionate about art. I love art. I'll get a big canvas in front of me and I start painting, and then I step back and I'm like, wow, this is not so good. Now, you had better outcome with the sculpture work, but I think when you give yourself space to explore enough to really figure out like where does your art meet your commerce and meet all the other things that you're really strong at, the things that you were acquiring going through your legal journey as a lawyer, when all those things add up, things can either add up and feel right, or they add up and they don't feel right, and you need to still keep pushing. But it sounds like on the music side, your scorecard added up.
It took off. It was interesting. I listened to your podcast with your father, and there was a moment when he talked about having so many different interests in art that went from music to writing to painting to many more.
Yeah, I think he even mentioned something that I hadn't. I was like, Dad, I don't even remember that at all.
And he enjoyed exploring all of them. But at some point, you have to dedicate to something that is really what you're probably best at. And it was very interesting. It was a really interesting point.
Well, I think what, you know, now that you bring that up, I think that when you really focus in on something, and I'm speaking for me, and I would imagine this resonates for you, when you have a lot of things that you're toying around with, but you focus in on something and you're able to make a living from it, there's something very fulfilling about being able to support yourself, especially when you're doing something that you love. And I think that's why I truly am glad that no one threw a ton of money at me to start Tibby. I think it made me be much smarter in the choices that I've made. And I'm glad that I really did look at this as my form of support, because it pushed me in ways that fulfilled me. And it all feeds into each other. I just don't think you can be creative for creative sake. And then if you don't have the other, I don't know that I would ever feel balanced, you know, and that balance is really important for me. And yeah, for my dad, like he was married, he was raising kids, you know, and we had a great life.
Great life.
It was when things were good, we could stay at the Holiday Inn on a road trip back home to Chicago, you know, like what more did I need?
Yeah, it was very, very interesting, very eye-opener in a way. At his age, how much and wisdom posture that you can tell on the interview. Yeah.
Posture.
Yeah.
I love that.
In posture. A good way.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's just like standing straight, but with ease at the same time, you know?
Yeah.
I love that. Thank you so much for being here, Javier.